Welcome to the Dope CFO Podcast, where you can find the best information for accountants and bookkeepers that want to start and grow a highly profitable and flexible remote cannabis accounting firm. With your host, Andrew Hunziker. Now that's dope.
Hey everybody, this is Andrew Hunziker, CPA, also CFO, founder of Dope CFO as well. About my background, I've been a CPA for over 25 years, was at a big four, including PricewaterhouseCoopers. I won the gold medal award for the highest score in the CPA exam, as well as was runner up for the Portland, Oregon Business Journal CFO of Year Award in 2017. And I was the first ever cannabis CFO to be nominated. Done lots of startup work as well. And love teaching all of our community. We have now over 500 people in all 50 states in our Dope CFO program. Hey, everybody. Super excited for today's show. This is going to be a little bit different. I know a lot of times on the Dope CFO podcast, we talk to other accountants in the niche, people in the Dope CFO program. But today we got a special guest, Dave Alport, super excited, dispensary owner, multi-state vertical operator, been in the industry since even way back before we met 5-6 years ago. We're going to cover a lot of ground. So first I'm going to turn it over to Dave. Introduce yourself. And before you go into kind of your cannabis is kind of your background, and we'll get started with that. It's always a colorful story how people even ended up in the industry at all to start with.
Well, first off, thank you for having me. It's very kind of you to take this time out of your busy schedule to meet with me and talk about these things. So, and about Bridge City. So, I appreciate you having me on. So we're super excited. My name is David Alport and I'm with Bridge City Collective. And to give you a little background on my start in the industry. So I went to school for business, to University of Puget Sound in Seattle. And after college, did a little bit of time at Nike, working over at the headquarters here in Portland, and then also worked for a little bit on the Mercantile Exchange in New York. So I was kind of going down that path, and I ended up trading into the recession in 2009. And so at that time, moved back to Portland. I had been involved in the cannabis industry and kind of knew quite a few growers and people in the industry, but at that point kind of made it my professional career, where I went, you know, full steam ahead and went into commercial production and turned it into, like, you know, what eventually became my full-time, my business. So that was in 2009. And I really honed my craft as a top shelf cultivator for the medical market. Founded Bridge City Collective in 2010 as a direct patient resource. At that time, I had considered opening up one of these stores in Portland, but didn't. And that building actually sat vacant for 4 more years, at which point we brought on the first licensed framework here in Oregon. So at that time, then opened up a for-profit dispensary, Bridge City Collective in the Southeast, and then another one in North Portland. So
was that 2013?
That was 2014. So this store on Williams opened June 11th of 2014. And the one in Southeast Grand was July 28th, 2014. We were two of the first stores and like original kind of known stores in Portland.
Now, let me ask you, jump in real quick. So just because I sometimes get my dates confused, I think Colorado legalized 2012 and then Oregon, Washington. I can't remember who went first. Was it? Were they both the same year?
It was right around the same time. Yeah. So we were like right in that early kind of, it was Colorado first and then us right after that. Oregon decriminalized in 1977. So we were the first state to decriminalize. And we were the second state to have a medical program. So California had their medical program in 1996 and Oregon established theirs in 1998.
So it's I love to talk about that fact of just how that whole almost 20-year period was just kind of drifting along over here on the West Coast. And then when Colorado jumped in, it kind of gave this kickstart. And then Oregon, Washington, and then California. And then all of a sudden, you know, a few years later, and holy crap, almost every state is legalized. And it's just gotten quicker and quicker, the speed every year. When you look at decades, it's like, holy crap, what's happened the last 4 or 5 years is just nuts.
Yeah. It's pretty crazy. And you know, we're constantly learning, like even Oregon now today is learning from what the newer states are doing and vice versa. So it's, a large national experiment that's taking place at the state level. So it's pretty cool to watch everything unfold.
And so you got those two dispensaries up and running, and you've had to deal with, and I tell people on the rules in any state, I was like, oh yeah, they're going to change constantly and evolve, and new politicians come in and new rules. So sure. You've had to see different rules come and go. Has it been frustrating to try to even keep up with all those rules here in Oregon?
Yeah, I mean, that's part of just working in the industry, right? Like compliance is really important, and there's constantly evolving regulations and rules and laws. In fact, we're actually pretty involved in trying to help craft those in more business and industry friendly ways. So that's a big part of what Bridge City Collective does here in Oregon and also in other states. So that's important to us to try to contribute and give back. And so just the changing nature of those, it can be cumbersome, but it's just a part of operating.
I may detour off some of our questions a little bit. So that's a great question, because I get this question a lot, people in other and newer states, like, how do I get involved with lobbying or legislation? People are like, I know I want to help change. Is there any great solution, or you just get involved with the nonprofit groups that are around?
Sure. So what happened for us here in Oregon, and this is a kind of a good blueprint or a good a way to go about it, is, you know, as the industry was beginning here, I started to look at the different trade associations that were forming. And back in 2015, that's when I came across the Oregon Retailers of Cannabis Association and Casey Houlihan. And at that time, there were a few other organizations that were developing, but I really liked Casey. He resonated with me. I could tell he was a down-to-earth guy, and that he was going to be very effective in dealing with regulators and legislators and communicating our message as an industry. So I aligned myself with him and Orca pretty early on, and kind of developed that relationship over time and took a board role pretty early on. And now that whole organization has grown up so much, and we're actually merging that organization with OIPA and Farms Inc. to create the Cannabis Industry Alliance of Oregon. And it's even bigger and more powerful today than it's ever been. So that's pretty exciting to see. So I think for someone that's going into a new state or that's in a newly developing state, they kind of want to assess the landscape first and think about the type of business that they're building and what associations are developing that suit their needs, and then kind of align themselves with those people.
And a great point you pointed out, and we've seen other people do this, is it's not that super hard. Once you do find Orca or whatever, they often will need new board members or just new members, and you can contribute. Or and there's just so many organizations I've seen come and go, whether it's Women of Weed or I mean, there's women groups or dispensary groups or farmer groups or whatever they are. There's lots and lots of groups.
Well, sometimes they aren't necessary anymore, right? So the need for a specific trade association might go away. So you see kind of fracturing and then also consolidation of trade associations in different markets, depending on what the needs of the industry are there.
Well, the needs and the size, and it's funny to see. And it's, we've got one dope CFO in Champaign, Illinois, where it's like a college town, It's kind of like Bend, Oregon, 100, and there's very little cannabis activity there because they're so restrictive there in Illinois still. And so I say, yeah, there's opportunities to get involved local on. Why don't we talk first about your trajectory? So you've been in Oregon, super involved, not just running. And I've seen this with Jeremy over here, former client of mine, people that, and I think that's different than some industries, like say, you know, my wife opened a bedding and dishware shop. She didn't go get involved in industry. A lot of people pushing this industry aren't just opening a dispensary. They're getting involved and giving back in the organization. So that's really good. But now you're moving into other states. So tell us kind of how that started and where that is now. I think you're in 7 states now, or?
Yeah. So, here in Oregon, we have 2 cultivation sites and 2 dispensaries. And in about 2016, realized that we had a skill set that some of these newer markets were going to need, right? And so trying to figure out where we could, add value. And so at that point, I came across my business partner, who is my main business partner today, Jason Cabus. And he's from Ohio. And so Ohio, the medical program there was developing. And so we made a push there and applied through 3 separate application processes for all 3 license types, for cultivation, processing, and retail. And we were successful in winning those at that time. So I think we were those licenses came through in 2017, I believe. And so we realized at that point that we were kind of onto something, that was something that we could really develop. And we kept kind of honing in on that skill, went to more states. We went to Missouri. We were one of 11 companies to win all 3 license types there. We went to Illinois. We've won licenses through the competitive application process for cultivation, processing, transportation, and retail. We were one of 10 companies to win a cultivation license in the Missouri medical round in 2019. And then actually during the pandemic, we purchased our way into Rhode Island and Massachusetts through distressed assets. So that's kind of our current footprint. We will be going into Florida this year. So we're applying there and we're very excited about that. So as far as that trajectory has gone, so I should mention too that Missouri is going to be an outlier. That one is in-state owned and controlled. So underneath this kind of emerging umbrella of Bridge City Collective, Missouri will not be included. But we are, in these kind of state siloed, separate entities in each state with different cap tables and different investors and different teams. And so for that reason, we think we can add a lot of value and have a coherent strategy in executing a roll up. So at some point over the next couple of years, we will be consolidating all of these states into one company and then going to market at some time after federal reform. So either through an IPO or some other go to market strategy.
Well, that's, sounds like an awesome strategy. And you all are being very successful on the licensing, winning those licenses, which is a huge deal as well. That kind of leads me into my next question. If you're out there thinking about starting a dispensary and I already know from via my wife how hard retail is just killer. But what are some of the myths around, like I could even do a 2-bar question around owning and running a dispensary, because I know there's a lot of myths. It's not as good as there's ups and downs. And then maybe even we'll do a 2nd part is, what's the best, I'll get this for people like Oklahoma or my friends in Texas or wherever. What's the best vertical? Should I go to cultivation or multi-vertical or processing or dispensary? So give us your thoughts on all that, because you've been around and you're involved in all verticals.
Sure. So some of the biggest myths surrounding running retail are that everyone's making money, right? it is a very challenging business. And especially in some place like Oregon, where we have, I think, 800 dispensaries right now and a couple hundred more in the pipeline. There's a lot of people that are struggling and that will not make it. And you also kind of hear that from people within the industry, like, you know, cultivators who look at our menu and they see our prices and they say, wow, you guys are making so much money. It seems like you're marking up everything so much. But what they don't understand is that the retail end of the plant touching businesses has the biggest 280E tax burden. So,
you know how many dispensaries deal with that? They ignore it and they do it wrong. And then they say they're profitable, but I was like, you're profitable until the IRS shows up and then you're going to
right. They haven't hired you yet.
Yeah. Or
they haven't hired a dope CFO yet.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's a great, and I think when we saw too, even the challenges, of course, when you have retail, and we're seeing this, I think this is almost more pandemic related. So like here in Bend, Oregon, I don't care where I go, to Starbucks, McDonald's, the dispensary, the first thing I see is we're hiring and there's a lot of trouble keeping staffing up. And I don't know if it's just the young people in the world have quit working or what's going on. Normally in recessionary times and inflation, people are looking for jobs, but that doesn't seem to be the issue here.
Yeah, it's a challenging time in general, right? Like the pandemic has been tough on us, you know, just it's worn the staff out. You know, we've had to, it's been, you know, people dealing with customers on the front line, you know, dealing with PPE. You know, if one person has been in contact with someone who's had COVID, then the whole staff anyways, you know, been in close proximity to that person is having to take off from work. And so dealing with those challenges has been tough. And then also really with the state of the economy and with inflation, it's a challenging time right now. And you really have to pay people enough for them, you know, to stay excited and also want to work for you and work with you. And so it's, you know, striking that balance can be challenging for sure.
Now, do you have any particular end of the vertical of which you think's the best, most lucrative, or like in my mind, like if I go out 10, 15 years, I think of things like, say you make power bars with CBD and THC in them, or you're just a really craft grower, like a craft brewer, and you can really hone in on your brand, as opposed to a dispensary might look more like a liquor store 10 years from now. And it's just, what's the nearest one to me? But how do you see that evolving as people get into the different, because some people, I hear this all the time too. Oh, the big players are going to gobble everyone up and there are not going to be any small players. And I don't believe that to be true either.
Yeah. I think, it really depends on what you're trying to build and what market you're in. Are you going to stay in a specific market, even within a state, or are you going to be trying to build something national or international? And what does that look like? Like, what is your role in that like larger framework? And for us, I mean, we're a craft cannabis company and producer. We're going to be focusing a lot on developing like very niche products and brands. And so we're kind of like a craft beer with, you know, footprints in various markets. We aren't trying to be a commodity type player where we're producing, you know, a million square feet in a greenhouse. You know, for us, that's kind of our strategy. And the vertical for us is really important. You know, the retail is important for us to have that touch point for our customers so that they can interact with the brand. And also in some markets, if you have a limited license structure, it can be very challenging as a wholesaler to get onto the shelves. And that real estate on the shelves is really important.
Super valuable.
But it's different in every market. And, you know, someplace like California, you know, everyone has to go through a distributor. So there's a forced transfer in the supply chain where that's an integral part of the operations there and how the industry works. Whereas in Oregon, you don't necessarily need to do that. You can sell from your farm directly to a dispensary. So the distributor here in Oregon is going to have a more challenging time than the distributor in California.
And
So,
and we won't even, I was going to say, we won't even go down the California rabbit hole because what a challenging state that is on every front. Yeah. But the, no, that's great.
Yeah. So, and I would say like what we're seeing now or like what is being discussed as far as like the larger MSOs are concerned is more consumer packaged goods companies, right? That they're trying to position themselves as CPG companies, building huge brands with gobbling up market share for like these larger brands, and then ideally selling those to someone like Coca-Cola or some of these other global conglomerates. So I think that's some of those guys, that's kind of their play. So yeah, I think it really depends. And it depends on what you're trying to do.
It's going to be, so this is another topic. Let's dive in a little bit to this on the valuation side, because this comes up all the time. And I think everyone has these different strategies. And I think many of them, whether you're small, big or whatever, are looking around federal legalization, because then, like you mentioned, Coca-Cola or Merck or Pfizer,
sure,
all these huge companies, as well as brand new SPACs or IPOs or whatever, people looking at big exits and strategies. So what, so one thing I tell my community, I say, first of all, there's no answer. People say, well, what, how do you value a dispensary? What's the multiple of EBITDA or whatever, or revenues? I say, first off, it changes over time. So that's one reflection. So the, you've owned a dispensary for almost 10 years in Oregon. The value of that dispensary with that location and that sales footprint has probably gone up and down over the last 10 years, depending on the market.
Sure. So, it used to be customary that the dispensaries were being valued as a multiple of revenue. And that was because of 280E. That was a way for dispensaries to be valued without having to consider, you know, that massive tax burden. And because of 280E, you have people that are, or company businesses that are kind of shifting costs into cost of goods sold. So sometimes those margins don't look right. And so you see a fluctuation on the retail side of a multiple of revenue, but you're also seeing like a multiple of EBITDA more and more these days. And that's becoming true across the board and across all verticals where, you know, cultivation, processing and retail are a multiple of EBITDA, and that's more common.
So, on the revenue side, were you seeing typically 1x revenues? Because I saw a couple of deals around here around a while back. And I know at one point there was that Canadian deal that was coming in trying to gobble people up.
Yeah, I've seen everything from 0.8 to like 2x revenue. So it's a big range.
And I say part of it too, especially on the retail side, is location. Like if someone sees a key location that they want, it might be better than like in Bend right here. There's some really nice locations, and then there's some other ones that aren't quite so nice. At least I wouldn't want to own, but even so, I know a guy that got out pretty nice pay. I think it was a little over 1x. And I saw the similar in high tech, and when some of these companies that are losing money for years and years and years, but they're still selling a multiple of revenues, even though, yeah, they may be losing a gazillion dollars. And then even the public companies like Tilray, they're again losing lots and lots of money, but their valuations have gone, at some points they've been ridiculously high.
And very low.
And very low.
So undervalued too. So over and undervalued. Yeah.
And when you get a new industry, high tech was definitely like this. I mean, and so people talk about Amazon, the stock price, like over the last 20 years, a big part of Amazon's history, they were not making any money, but the stock price, I forgot what I heard it when it was from its peak to low, like six different times it dropped like 80% in price or whatever it was. And so these wild swings, we see the same in crypto, we see the same in cannabis. And so when you have new industries, you got to be able to stomach wide price swings.
I think for a publicly traded company that's, you know, operating, you need to have really strong cash flows and profitability so that you're not relying on that as much, right? On that investment in the public markets, because that could crush you. So if you're, building out too much and you don't have the position to support that and you're publicly traded, that could be a challenge. But comparing, you know, the cannabis industry to tech industry, that's tough, you know, and the investors are looking at those in different ways. So, yeah.
And and I tell people when if they say, oh, I'm going to start a dispensary, you know, Oklahoma's kind of the same. There's a gazillion dispensaries. It's like, look, if you're not funded, you don't have deep pockets, it's going to be really tough. There's going to be a lot of competition. And even we saw it in Oregon too, you know, people were picking up assets, you know, coming in 2017 or 18 or whatever, and just, oh, you spent $10 million building out that farm, I'll give you $1 million for it. And it's already built. You don't have the time factor and you don't have to spend $10 million to build it out. So we're
starting to see that right now too. We're in another down cycle right now. And it's peculiar to me when you see new money coming in such a challenging market, but
them come in.
So doing it.
Well, that's great to know. Let me see here. What I wanted to ask too, this is always a good question. What if you could kind of go back in time to 2012 or 10 or whenever, like, and had to do all this over, would you do it exactly the same way you've done it? And you're, cause you're pretty successful. So you've had a really good 10-year run.
Well, I would say that, you know, this all is a very big startup still for us. We're relatively small based on the size of the footprint that we're building. So we haven't really hit that inflection point yet of being operational with that large of a revenue and profitability. You know, we are operational in 4 states, but it's relatively small based on, you know, the size of the company that we're building. But, you know, would I change anything? You know, of course, there's a lot of mistakes that, you know, I've made that I would have, if I could go back and do those differently, you know, hindsight's 20/20.
Yeah.
But also that's how you learn, right? Is just kind of put it, you know, throwing yourself into the fire and getting into it and seeing what happens in a lot of ways. If there was any kind of advice I would give to someone who's starting a new cannabis company, I would say, really kind of think about your marketing strategy and be prudent about how you're spending those dollars. So kind of spread your money out in a bunch of different ways and test things out in like small amounts and then figure out what's working for you. And then kind of really double down on the, whatever that strategy is.
That sounds like great. And marketing and even distribution and sales, because even when I came in kind of late over to Hi-Fi, when I got originally involved, they had some really great things going for them. They were pretty well funded, but underfunded in my opinion. And that actually came to kind of bring them down. But one key in I've seen this, not just in their model, but many financial models, it's especially in the cultivation side. We got this whatever square foot facility, we're going to grow X number of pounds of pot and we're going to sell it at this price and we're going to sell all of it at this price. And there may be, I remember 2017 going in, I was like, oh yeah, we've got pot but we can't even sell it at any price. Nobody wants it or there's too much. And so you got to make darn sure it's not just simple math. It's not like you're producing natural gas. Like when I was back in Oklahoma and like, oh yeah, here's the price of gas and we'll produce it. It's trickier than that. You've got to make sure that the people actually want your product.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. That can be a challenge for sure. And that's different in every market, right? That's why, you know, some limited license markets are attractive to people and businesses. And I think that's one lesson we're learning still here in Oregon, is that some kind of a controlled market is probably a good idea. That if everyone wants this to be an opportunity for independent business owners, like having the free market is actually harmful to those people. That the only people that are really going to win in an oversaturated market are the larger companies.
Larger people who can fund it.
Yeah. So
do you have any particular state that is your absolute favorite? Like, oh, that state's actually doing it right.
Yeah. So, every state's so different. And I think it's the states that are striking a balance with enough licenses that it's got some diversity to it, but not so many licenses where it becomes more challenging for everyone to operate. I think Illinois has done a really good job. They're going to cap their dispensary licenses at 500. So that seems like a good market. That's pretty well balanced. And I think you asked me this earlier, not on this call yet, but, what I thought about the licensing schemes in the various, and the regulatory frameworks in the various states. And there's a couple ways to look at it. I think there's three ways to look at it. There's the fact that this shouldn't be illegal in the first place, yep. Right? Like, so prohibition has been, it's been wrong. Yeah. So any state that's decriminalizing is doing the right thing there. And then looking at this through the lens of social justice, I think is really important, because there's people and communities that have been adversely impacted by prohibition, and that needs to be recognized and addressed. And so, anytime like a new state's bringing on licenses or developing the industry, when they have that in mind, I think that's really important. And then again, just having the right balance of licenses and licensed canopy, you know.
Yeah, so. And doing a state and like you said, yeah, like 800 dispensaries for Oregon is way too many. We only have one big city here, and it's not even that big. And then right. You look at Chicago, which or Illinois is like 3x Oregon or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. Having more diversity you want to have enough to provide those. And we hadn't even talked about all the social equity issues that we're seeing, where some of those people got to be super careful not to get tricked by their investors and people coming in saying, oh yeah, we'll give you money to get your license, but then trying to take over the whole company. After kind of beating the whole idea of it, like, oh, we're going to give Sally this equity license, but really the big deep pocket investors are going to come grab it and control it.
Depending on how that plays out, it still might accomplish the goal that the state and the program is intending to do. So, in Illinois, for example, you know, there's people that basically got these, you know, golden tickets. Yeah. They're getting paid $5 to $10 million for that. That is a massive life-changing amount of money for those people.
And don't tell me. So it's funny you mentioned that, because so one of those golden ticket holders, their investor offered them $300,000. They already had 40% for getting the license, and they offered him, I think, $300,000 for another 50%. And that was my exact comment. Are you nuts? This license is worth $10 million at least. Don't sell them half of it for $300,000. But I think you're right. Those licenses are worth a lot of money, and they need to recognize that. But they need that support. They need people that can operate, people like your company that can actually know how to run a business. Because, I mean, running.
Well, that's the other challenge, right? Because, you know, and New York's trying to figure this out. You know, the Dormitory Authority is raising a $200 million fund for this. And they're going out and they're securing like 100 or 150 retail locations that they're going to build into like a certain condition and basically gift those to the licensees and say, okay, here's a store, you know, here's funding from our Dormitory Authority. Now you can build this store. But the other thing that they're trying to do is make sure that the people that are winning those licenses, not only have they been adversely impacted, so they've been arrested, but they've also had business experience, like operating experience of any business type. And so I know that's a smaller pool of people, but I'm sure there's certainly more than 150 of those out there. And they're kind of thinking about it in that way to try to set them up for success.
Success. So. And in Dope CFO, I think on our side, kind of, which I always look at the back half of the company, which is accounting, tax, HR, compliance, all those kind of things, we can hopefully help. And we encourage Dope CFOs to go volunteer at least with one or two social equity applicants. You'll learn a ton of stuff. You'll be helping someone because they need a ton of that guidance. And they're actually fun to work with because they know they need that guidance because they might not have that kind of experience.
Sure.
By the way, I know you've worked off and on with some dope CFOs, so I'll get after you for not a plug, but have you had a good experience with any dope CFOs?
So I think we met in 2017 or 2018. When did you found Dope CFO?
It was right around then. And so I was kind of in this weird transition where I was still trying to get clients, but I was launching this. And I think late 2018, it was when I was like, no more client work.
So at that time you introduced me to Summer Wilkinson, who did your program, and Frank Palomino, who's also a dope CFO. Yeah. And we still work with them at the stores here in Portland today. And they've done a great job. I mean, they're doing gap accounting here for the stores, and all of our accounting is very buttoned up. And
that's so good to hear. And I talk about Summer a lot on my podcast and my groups because she was so amazing, where she was sitting there in Dallas, Texas. And most people who buy my program now actually talk to on the phone, but she just gave me an email and was like, I think she wanted some work papers. I just launched it. She's like, I want to do this. I want to go into cannabis. I mean, cannabis was legal nowhere back then. It was in Oregon, Washington, and Colorado. Here she is in Texas. And I was like, great, you come jump on these Oregon clients and actually do things right. And she's super sharp.
Yeah, she's great. She's done a fantastic job for us.
So that's awesome to hear. And just showed how, really, if you do good quality, and that's my pitch to Dope CFO too. It's the same exact thing to a dispensary or a brand. If you can develop a high quality product, there's always room. My favorite motto is Daniel Webster 200 years ago, there's always room at the top. So whether that's the highest quality craft brew or the best joint or the top level accounting services, there's always room for you right now, 100 years from now. And so that's the market we want to serve as well. This has been an awesome podcast. I'm sure we may have to do a follow-up at some point because people are going to be like, ask me, well, does that mean I can get 3x revenues for my dispensary? we'll see what people say, but I want to tell us kind of where people can find you the best way and your companies, because I know you're all over in all these states as well, but you're still headquartered in Portland.
Sure. So Bridge City Collective will ultimately be our corporate identity as we evolve as a company. But right now it's pretty small. If you're looking at us, you know, just on Google or something, but that would be the main place to find us is Bridge City Collective.
Well, awesome. And we'll put all this in the show notes as well. Maybe do a follow-up, but it's going to be fun. It's already been fun. Like I told people, like I hadn't been to an Orca event in quite a while. And I saw you and Jeremy and Julia was there It's fun to see people's progress. And, you know, I fully expect you guys someday you'll be billionaires. I'll be like, new day.
maybe not that much money, but, hopefully we'll have some success and we can build something that's meaningful along the way where we can really build, something that we're giving back to communities, and that's a responsible business. So we're excited. And
that's a great note to end on, because that is the number one thing I've liked about this industry. The founders are mostly active, pushing the movement for the best reasons, for social justice and all that. Yes, you want to make money and do well, but it's just such a great industry, whether you look at it from the medical side or decriminalization or whatever. And that makes it fun to be a part of.
Absolutely.
You've been listening to the Dope CFO Cannabis Accounting Podcast. Every other Monday, we air tips and insights on cannabis and CBD hemp accounting. Make sure you subscribe today and also check us out on Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn, Twitter, YouTube. We're pretty much everywhere for more advice, tips, industry news as well. To find out more about our cannabis and CBD accounting program, visit dopecfo.com and don't forget to be dope.